Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of 342 Productions. I am your host, Nikias Duncan, and joining me as always is my co-host, Steve Jones Jr. Steve, how are you doing, sir?
Feeling good, feeling great. Happy to be here. Excited to be here. Thank you, Dunkers, for once again embracing your bounce. Dunker Nation, stay locked in. This show's going to be stacked and packed, so let's ride. Nikias, it is time to hoop it up.
It is indeed time to hoop it up. A little watch party candy in the opener. I respect it. But let's get to some news. We have some playoff basketball games to talk about. We'll knock out these news items relatively quickly since we didn't get to them on Monday as we did our playoff preview. Check that out if you haven't already. We will start on the NBA side. The Spurs, who acquired Campaign over the offseason in a trade, taking on some salary, getting some picks, etc. They have waived Campaign, who once again averaged 10 points, 4.5 assists last season in 15 starts, averaged 15 points and 7 assists, 42% on twos, 39% on threes, 77% from the line. Steve, are there any landing spots that kind of pop for you for Campaign?
Well, with Campaign, it's a little tricky. I believe we've seen the talent. I know he can contribute to a good team. The first one that popped up to me was maybe Milwaukee was in my head as far as somewhere where he could probably assist a team that's looking to win and both have maybe a role and also an opportunity to continue the winning. That's going to be the tricky part for him, though. What other spots does he land where he's going to get a mix? Did you have any in mind?
For me, Milwaukee's at the top of my list because as I was going through teams, I was like, wait a minute, who exactly is Milwaukee's backup point guard right now? Like in a traditional sense, because obviously Giannis will handle a bunch, Chris will handle a bunch, Drew's going to handle a bunch, and then kind of cycle through. It's like, I don't know if they have like a traditional, not that Campaign is a table setter per se, but like, I don't think they have one. So like that fits as a team that has a need for a backup point guard. And to your point, wants to blend in the role and opportunity with the chance to win. I think Milwaukee would give Campaign that. Beyond that, I guess keep an eye on Miami, who I think still has one standard roster spot open right now. Obviously, they're still in limbo with the Damian Lillard discussions that haven't gone much of anywhere to this point. And so depending on if something gets done there and more roster spots open up or if there's a need for extra ball handling coming off the bench, that feels like a natural landing spot. How would you feel about Philly?
Didn't they just get Pat Bev?
They did.
I'm not sure about Philly just because I don't know how much playing time is there going to be. I guess it depends on, you know, waves arms wildly, but they got Pat Bev. They also have Melton. They have Tyrese Maxey. It's like, how much opportunity would he have to do Campaign adjacent things?
I guess for me, like what made that pop for me, the waves aren't wildly makes. I mean, that's going to be the natural spot there. But beyond that, with the Anthony Melton and Pat Bev, like they both feel like we are point of attack defenders that can do stuff against tilted defenses versus someone like Campaign that can kind of initiate some stuff and kind of kick things off with rim pressure. So like there may be opportunity to play like Campaign and Pat Bev together in certain lineups or Campaign and Anthony Melton together in certain lineups. And Cam will still have a little bit more of the leeway to do some of the ball handling with those guys playing more in the off-ball role. But to your point, yeah, like it is still Maxey. It is still Pat Bev. It is still Melton. And, you know, if Harden is coming into camp or if he's there for like the first couple of weeks of the regular season or something until something gets done, if something gets done, then, yeah, that kind of limits how much Cam gets there role-wise. So I hear you. I'm trying to think anything else. Maybe Cleveland?
Toronto?
They could use another point guard. I could see a Toronto fit. Toronto's interesting. Because Cleveland also just has... They have so many guards they already don't play, though.
Just throwing options out.
Oh, I got you. That kind of... Do the Clippers look to add another one? They're also part of the Waves Aren't Wild Leap Grade, so like I don't know. Feels like Milwaukee's probably top of mind for everyone in this regard. Anyway, we'll keep an eye on what happens with Campaign and his free agency. Other free agency notes. Tristan Thompson, Cleveland Cavalier, once again agreeing to a 1-year deal. Kevin Knox and the Blazers agreeing to a 1-year deal. Either of those raised a brow for you at all, or that is just me just reading the transaction wire?
I mean, we'll see. This is always fun to see who gets the training camp deals, because you do have to fill those spots, have enough people and bodies for that in the preseason. So I'm always fascinated to see when these guys make the team. Tristan in Cleveland is funny. But other than that, nah.
Okay. We will see if Kevin Knox can find the jumper again. Did not have the three ball going in Portland in his stretch there. So we will see a little bit of potential there, I guess, that Portland sees with him offensively. It's a guy that could be a potential mismatch issue. But anyway, quick update on Trey Murphy III, as we talked about a little bit, I guess a week or so ago at this point. Trey Murphy did have the partial meniscus tear. There was some conversation about whether he would have the repair versus just what kind of procedure he would have. It looks like he is going to have surgery and go with the repair. So that would take him out between 10 to 12 weeks, reportedly. So we're looking at a early, mid November, maybe late November timeline for him. So get well soon, Trey. As we did not talk about it Monday, congrats to Germany for winning the FIFA World Cup. They are officially the world champions, I guess. An 83-77 victory over Serbia. Team USA naturally not making that game, since they are neither Germany nor Serbia. Lost to Germany in the semifinals, 113-111 in the close one. And then in the bronze medal game, lost to Canada, 127-118 in overtime. A game in which Dylan Brooks went off for 39 points and let everybody know about it. So that was a lot of fun. Congrats to Canada for a very productive and solid run for them. On the Team USA front, the loss has apparently sparked the big guns looking at it and saying, okay, we gotta shape this up. We gotta do the thing. LeBron James appears ready to commit, per Sham Sharania of The Athletic. LeBron has spoken to / recruited Steph Curry, Kevin Durant, Anthony Davis, Jason Tatum, Draymond Green. And Shams also reported that Devin Booker, Damian Lillard, De'Aaron Fox, and Kyrie Irving are also interested in committing for the Team USA squad, the Olympic squad, next year in Paris. Do we feel, I guess before even getting to the Olympic route, because we talked a lot about what Team USA's potential shortcomings could be in terms of their size, the fouling, some of the flow stuff offensively. I guess, is this worth, I don't want to say overreaction, but is this worth overreaction with how this tournament went for Team USA? Do they, quote unquote, need the big stars to win?
Define worth overreaction, because overreaction happened no matter what. The end of the run, despite me trying to break down, hey, here's why Halliburton and Brunson's minutes are like this, and the starting lineup's like this, and the struggles they have, and the defense, and the margin for error that they have. It was the same conversation for literally 10, 12, 14 days. So I don't know if it's overreaction. The Olympic team is always going to be stronger than the World Cup team. I think the challenge for the World Cup team is trying to find A, the base that you want, and B, the players that are willing to commit that kind of fit that base. This Team USA roster was built around versatility. You could probably argue it lacked some size, but you could see the vision of what they were trying to put together. That did open the window for certain things. We don't know who they had in mind and maybe didn't want to do it, anything like that. So I think for Team USA, when those folks decide to show up for the Olympics, it's a different team. I think this World Cup team did a good job as far as showing, hey, we can build a different base. We can compete with certain players. And I think those guys came together quickly. Obviously, disappointed as far as the result goes, but I thought their growth over most of the tournament was pretty fun to watch.
Yeah, there we go. I guess to the overreaction point, just I don't think anyone should be acting like Team USA is in dire straits because they didn't medal. Like, to your point, it was a disappointing outcome. But one, the teams they're facing were also just really good and could hammer some of the weaker points of this roster. And two, to the Olympic point, there is more talent to bring if they feel like this group wasn't going to cut it. And so I'm excited to see just how many of the quote unquote big dogs commit and how they round that out. I would say going from the FIBA World Cup to the Olympic team, I just want to see what the center room is going to look like on the actual Olympic roster, because I think that's where you felt the lack of commitments from some of the others. Like, you're not going to see Anthony Davis in this at this stage of his career. You're not going to see Bam Adebayo, especially after another finals run. Like, how much different does that look with one or both of those guys in tow next year? What kind of versatility does that unlock for this Olympic squad? And if that's kind of your weaker point and you're able to add one or two of those guys, like, this should be a Team USA team that's favorite to win gold in Paris. And so, like, I don't have any major qualms. For me, it's more so props to everyone else versus this is a flawed roster or flawed roster making thing or such and such is overrated. Like, I don't think we have to go too far on Jaren. Like, it wasn't his best effort towards the back end of the tournament. The foul trouble hurt. You saw some of the lack of size stuff against the post-ups, but, like, ultimately he's still really freaking good. Like, I'm not super concerned with Austin Reeves. Think the connect the power that he had offensively popped, the shooting, the driving, the quick decision making. We also saw teams go after him on switches. Like, I want to see, like, how he's able to, I guess, counter that as we get into this NBA season in a few months. And if teams go to more of the mismatch hunting, like we saw some elements of that in last year's postseason for Austin Reeves, for all he did well offensively. Like, teams did try to put him in action late in games during the postseason. So, like, how does he build on that? But I don't really have any major shifts in opinion on the team or the players on the roster. So I just wanted to get your thoughts there. Again, a hat tip to Germany, to Dennis Schröder for winning the World Cup. And now we wait for this NBA season to kick off. We're not too far from training camp, which means a division preview for the Dunker Spot right around the corner. Going to have some fun digging into that in a few weeks. That is all I have there. We can now shift to the WNBA playoffs, in which we got a couple of game ones. We talked through it on the preview with Mark. Some pathways for the Minnesota Lynx, some potential pathways for the Chicago Sky. And we got a 30-point win by the Sun and a relatively big win for the Las Vegas Aces as well. If I can do math, I think that's 28 points. Not what I had on the bingo card, even with those teams being favored. We can start with the Sun, a 90-60 victory over the Minnesota Lynx. The Sun drained 9 first half threes, which is a playoff franchise record for them. Finished 16 of 30 from beyond the arc. They had 28 assists on 33 made baskets. Alyssa Thomas, we'll say one of the front runners for MVP this season. That will be announced, I think, in a couple of weeks at this point. With 10 assists, go along with 15 points and 5 steals. Dewana Bonner with 17, 15, and 6. Rebecca Allen with 15 points, also played very well defensively. I guess zooming out on a general note, Steve, what kind of pop for you in this game for the Connecticut Sun?
A few things pop for me. The number one thing was their guard play. When the Connecticut Sun get their guard play going, that changes the math. And one of the best things, obviously we're going to talk about the shooting here in a second, but one of the things that stood out to me early in that game were the drives from their guards, whether it was Tiff Hayes, Heidemann, Rebecca Allen, they were getting into drive and kick. It wasn't just off Alyssa Thomas handoffs. And that was like, oh, you add the cutting, you add the tempo, you add AT, now you're making shots. That is where the Connecticut Sun have worked towards. And that's why the regular season matters. You take those lumps, you try and figure things out, et cetera, et cetera. The shooting was insane. The shot making they had was insane. They hit 9 threes in the first half, right? Mm-hmm. I think at one point they had made as many threes as they had made twos. That makes it different. Like the Connecticut Sun hitting threes are a completely different team. I thought Minnesota had an opportunity early in that game, but I think it goes back to something we talked about in the preview as far as they really have to nail X, Y, and Z to have a shot. Mm-hmm. You know, for me, it's kind of like when you talk about these playoff series, everyone likes to go with the 1-8s, 2-7, slam dunks. My mind always goes to, okay, well, how do I figure out how they could win? Let's talk about that. Now, the problem is you ever wake up and you're running late and you know you have just enough time to make it to where you need to go, but you can't miss any lights. You need to hit everything, every single thing has to go your way. That's kind of where the Lynx are at in this series. And I think this game showcased that while they can hit some things, if they don't, it's going to be trouble. Defensively, I thought they had some solid possessions, but the help, the timing of the help, the overhelping, they put Dorka on AT to start. And then they doubled as well. I'm like, well, you're just opening things up. You're getting beat on closeouts. And now the guards again are getting into drive and kick. They didn't have an answer for Alyssa Thomas as a roller. It was either a layup or three people there to help. And then offensively, they didn't have a blend going. The shooting wasn't there. They tried movement, but Connecticut was physical and active defensively. So, you know, you end up hitting the clock. You try and put Kayla McBride in pick and roll. Connecticut traps early. You try and go, big plug time. Nekias Duncan, one of the greatest of all time, wrote a first-round playoff preview on WNBA.com, and he mentioned the Minnesota Lynx and their love for inverted pick and roll, having their guard screen for Nafisa Collier. The Connecticut Sun said, hey, we have Alyssa Thomas. Slide over. Well, there goes that. And so what type of shots were you generating? Could you get in the paint? Did you have the movement? What were you attacking? They just never really found that blend, and the Sun kind of took off. I know you really dove into this game today, so I'm very interested to see your thoughts and your takeaways from game one.
Well, first, thank you. Two, very quickly on the three-point note. As we mentioned, again, 16 made threes for the Sun, 9 in the first half, which was a playoff franchise record for them. 9 threes in the first half. The Sun had 8 games all year long in which they made 9 or more threes. Anytime you have that kind of discrepancy, like, it's just kind of tough. And it's not even like if someone didn't watch the game, you said, hey, the Sun made 16 threes, or they made 9 in the first half. Your immediate thought is going to be Dawana Bonner went off or Rebecca Allen went off, I would imagine. The fact that it was Tiffany Hayes taking unders and just knocking down threes. If you're Minnesota, it's like, well, this is the game plan. This is the quote unquote smart gamble to make. We want to duck under these guards, make sure they don't pressure the rim and get downhill against us. This hasn't been a great 3-point shooting team all year long. Let's keep things in front and, you know, send help when necessary, et cetera. If they're draining threes against unders, what do you do? Like, this wasn't an efficient 3-point night for Dawana Bonner in this one. And it didn't matter because they got it from elsewhere.
I wanted to tap on the under button that you just hit there, Nekias.
Mm-hmm.
Not only were they hitting threes, Connecticut was going to an automatic on those unders to where it was just, we're going right to a rescreen. And that's the danger with an under, because if you go under and we go right to a rescreen, you're in position to get screened. And now the defense has to react very quickly. So that was very interesting to see the Sun just quickly go through that. And I thought their pace and tempo was good as far as their movement went. But the Sun were ready.
The Sun were ready indeed. And to the Minnesota defense point on that, you already mentioned like them ducking under and just getting hammered on screens. I wanted to bounce quickly off of your help point, because that was something that you pointed out live during the watch party last night. Again, rock with us, folks. We are watching these games, having fun, breaking down some stuff live. But anyway, that was something that you hit live. And as I rewatched earlier today, I was like, man, the Sun just hammered the Lynx anytime they tried to peel in their help early. And early on, it was just, oh, you're already at the nail. I'm just going to make this quick kick. Oh, okay, you're peeling in a little bit earlier trying to get out of there. We're not going to have a pin in behind you. So now you can't get back as you try to recover. Okay, cool. You're trying to counter that. Now we're just going to cut from that spot and see how you deal with it from there. And it just felt like anytime Minnesota began to have any kind of footing with what to do, as Connecticut tried to run a handoff or pick and roll elsewhere and load up some help, Connecticut countered it. They could never stay on the same page. And if you're allowing Connecticut to just poke at pockets all the time without it having to be like 80 usage Alyssa Thomas, and you're unlocking everyone, this is the most dangerous version of the Sun. In which now you can get a little bit of everything. We can get to pick and roll and generate good stuff. We can get to handoffs and generate good stuff. We can get to elbow touches and cut off of that and get into good stuff. We can go to Alyssa Thomas post-ups and see what you do with it. If it's one-on-one, she can pivot and spin and get to her spots and knock down shots or get to the line. If you send a double, well, now, again, we're playing against your help again. And if your help isn't keyed in, we're generating from there. It was like a nice mix of we have our set stuff and we're doing that with good pace and good tempo. We're beating your help. And just in general, if our first or second option doesn't work for most of this game, because there was a pocket in the second quarter or like late first, early second quarter where the Lynx kind of settled in. But for the most part, Connecticut was just able to flow even when their initial stuff wasn't working. And that isn't something that we've been able to see consistently from this Connecticut team. So it was encouraging to see from there. And for Minnesota, they have to figure out what they want to do with the help. And outside, I was kind of threatening things earlier. It's like, okay, it looks like they are getting a little conservative in pocket, a little bit more conservative in pockets, not being as strong with their nail help on some stuff. I was like, I wonder if this is something that may carry over in the game too. And it becomes more of a one-on-one dare or a two-on-two dare, depending on what Connecticut's running. But it just got really tough for that Minnesota Lynx defense.
It was the timing of the help more than anything. They had some really solid active possessions, and then they would go ahead and either overhelp at the nail or overhelp on the weak side, and then they would get punished for it. So I think they got to find the balance of staying solid, keeping the ball in front, and timing and knowing when to help and why you're helping, as opposed to just doing it because it's the scheme. And some of the help felt like, we're supposed to do this. We're supposed to be in. And now you get hit by the cuts, the pin-ins that you mentioned. So they just need to find the nuance with the help. Because this was, Connecticut did have a stretch where they didn't score for 2-3 minutes in that first quarter. That game was back and forth in that first half to a degree, but Minnesota couldn't take advantage on the other end to put the pressure back on Connecticut. And that's where it's like, okay, one thing also leads to the other. And it goes back to what we said in the preview. Do they have enough on both ends to make this work? How are you going to free up Nafisa Collier? What actions are you going to run to get her going? She got going as the game progressed, but Alyssa Thomas was also with her a whole lot during that stretch. So, you know, who else is going to show up? I thought Kayla McBride was really good in the first half, but then how can you keep her going? Can you get some drives? Is your move going to work? Can you attack Dawana Bonner in the post? You got to find something on that end to make it tougher for Connecticut to generate. Because I think everyone forgets, in this push for Alyssa Thomas's MVP and talking about super teams, Connecticut's a very good defensive team. And their defense is what brings them, you know, keeps them at this level. And so if you're not ready to play and execute and punish them, it's going to be a long night. 13 assists for the Lynx. They had as many assists as made free throws, Nikias.
Yeah, that can't be the thing. Also, if it's 13 assists for the Lynx and 10 for Alyssa Thomas, that's probably not a winning battle for you. But no, to the Lynx offense point, and I guess we can start with like the inverted offense in general, because it's pick and roll, and it's also some of the off-ball stuff that Minnesota wants to do as well. I kind of feel for Minnesota because they don't have a ton of options based on the spacing that they have available to them. And so kind of inverting things and, again, hunting for mismatches is a way for them to generate some good offense, hopefully draw two and be able to play out of that. I feel for them just on a human level, because it's easy for me to like watch the game and then like clip things from earlier today. And be like, man, the screening effectiveness has to be better. Like, they have to lay these hits on Alyssa Thomas to force the switch, so Nafisa Collier has easier avenues to attack. That is very physically taxing. I am not jealous of any of Minnesota's guards having to screen Alyssa Thomas 10, 12, 14 times a game. That is a lot to have to deal with on cross screens, just traditional pick and roll. If they're, you know, posting, setting up shop at the elbow and having the piece of collar cut off, those are a lot of bumps to take against Alyssa Thomas, who is one of the stronger players in the W and also just generally good at navigating screens anyway. So even if you lay the contact, it may not matter. And then you have to defend on the other end with all of the handoffs and cuts and pick everything you got to do on that end. I probably underrated just how physically taxing this series is going to be for Minnesota, in addition to the talent deficit and arguably the shooting deficit between the two rosters. It's just really tough. But to bounce off of something you said earlier, I was really impressed with just how aggressive Connecticut was in the many avenues that they got to it. Because Minnesota tried different things. It wasn't from a lack of effort from their front. Like, they tried to empty a side. They tried to run stuff with more tempo. And anytime they felt like they could turn the corner, Connecticut had a second defender right there. Like, I go back to one of the second half possessions where Kayla McBride runs off a screen on one side, runs off to the other side, she catches and turns, and DaWanna Bonner's in her face already. First half possession, excuse me. And it's a turnover and a bucket. And it's like, well, if that's your one movement shooter and she's getting blitzed immediately, what do you do? You try to go empty side pick and roll with Tiffany Mitchell, who has been very good in terms of her rim pressure and her drives for Minnesota this year. She has to step up as a starting point guard with Lindsey Allen out. If she can't turn the corner because she can't see her teammates, well, what do you do? And based on where they're running their actions, even if you want to have a relief pass above the break or something, Connecticut is so good at recovering. Depending on how you're spacing that, they may be able to get out to that pass and also help off of a non-shooter at the same time. So you can't even have a traditional advantage from that. And so it's not impossible for Minnesota. And they were able to find some pockets. Again, like when the inverted screens hit, they were able to force some switches or get some temporary blips against Connecticut's defense and open up some stuff from there. Like there was that first quarter post-up against Dorca, who didn't even seem like it was a design play. It was just kind of reading what DaWanna was looking at and then sealing again inside position. It was a quick touch for her. She got some free throws. You can't build the boat out of Dorca Juha's post-ups, but like that is a button they could press a little bit more. If for no other reason than just to slow things down, see if we can get one of the front court players in foul trouble, give yourself a better chance throughout the game. But it's kind of feeling like just a roster limitation issue, which that's what a 3-6 matchup is supposed to be. Once you think about it, like the Sun are a better team for a reason. So I'm curious to see like what counters Minnesota tries to execute offensively in particular. Like they have to find a way to loosen Fee up aside from just the inverted stuff. To your point, but also like, can you hammer the Kayla McBride button a little bit more? Can you find her on more slips so she isn't getting trapped and getting easier avenues there? Do you want to run some of your ball screens higher? So if Connecticut does try to trap, you at least have a little bit more floor to work with and you can try to play out of that. I'm curious to see like where they go from here.
I mean, quicker decisions will help. If you're Minnesota, you're sitting back and, hey, we shot 35%. We made 5 threes, 5 of 25. So we left a lot on the table offensively. And I think if they can flip, find some of that, stay aggressive, make quicker decisions, go to driving quicker, go to dribble handoffs quicker, back cut against Connecticut's pressure. Like, there's things they can hit after seeing the tape. The question is, are they going to hit them? I mean, they can't do this again. And they have to make it a fight of some sort. Because if you get behind, now your pace comes up. Now you're taking quicker shots. That kind of helps the Sun. So the balance has to be there for Minnesota. I still think the formula is there, but very clearly, if they don't hit those, they don't have a shot.
Yeah, again, I might say it could get kind of tough very quickly. I guess one thing that surprised me now that I'm thinking about it, because I talked about this a little bit to the lead up of the series. Like Minnesota, very comfortable throwing out zone. I don't remember any zone possessions from the Lynx. Like, could you see that as a game two counter to try to throw off some of the tempo and the rhythm from Connecticut?
Well, I mean, again, you got to remember, 3-game series, so it's an elimination game. So it's also a throw everything at the wall type of game. Mm-hmm. So that's where it does get tricky in the W. Game ones are very important. You still got to win game two. So there's a lot of things Minnesota could throw at Connecticut to throw them off, whether it's zone, flipping matchups, anything like that. So I wouldn't be surprised. I wouldn't be surprised by any of that.
Chelsea, like Minnesota has done so in multiple regular season games this year where opening possession is just zone. Like you'll see teams go to it situationally on like a sideline, out of bounds play or something like that. Minnesota would just start there for a few possessions and see what you do. So I wouldn't be surprised if we see it in game two. They may need to. If they're super worried about the help, just very quickly on that front, because on the preview pod, I made the note, like just in terms of the mentality of Diamond Miller, like I wouldn't be surprised if she had a big game or just wasn't afraid of the moment. Not that she was, like, I don't think that was the case, but Connecticut did just kind of pick at her as a help defender in game one quite a bit. And so one thing I'll be watching in game two is, does Shel Reeve like shorten the hook with Diamond Miller at all? Because I do think it's worth noting, like, some of the best defensive stretches that Minnesota had in that game. You talked about that stretch late in the first quarter where Connecticut couldn't score. It was with Diamond off the floor. And that's just, it's a rookie in a playoff setting. nothing, you know, no long-term red flag or anything like that. But I do wonder if she'll re-seize that. Like, hey, this is a must-win game. This might have to be a 17, 18-minute Diamond Miller game if she can't hold up defensively. So,
I mean, she played 18 minutes in the last one.
Oh, well, there we go.
She played 18 in game one. So, I mean, they got to find their combinations of who's going to put the most pressure on Connecticut. Mm-hmm. I mean, we saw the game. It was a great game by Connecticut. It was 24-22 Minnesota with 7 minutes left in the second quarter. Yeah. So, again, there is value to what they attempted. But, again, they left their foot off the pedal a little bit. Offensively went a little too quick. Now, all of a sudden, you're down again, and you're fighting the same fight in the half court. Mm-hmm. So how are they going to do that? And then Connecticut, can they stay grounded within that success? What's it going to look like when those shots aren't going down? When you're not 16 to 30 from three? When you're struggling and you're in the mud a little bit? And if Minnesota finds something, do we see a different game? But Connecticut's up there for a reason. And they showed it last night.
Boy, did they. We can transition to the late game on the slate from yesterday. The Las Vegas Aces with a 87-59 victory. Chelsea Gray, 20 points, 4 boards, 7 assists, 2 steals, and 2 blocks in this one. 18 points, 6 assists, and 3 steals for Jackie Young. A quieter in the box score game for Asia Wilson. 14 points and 8 boards, but she did have 4 blocks and countless other contests for the Sky. 15 points for Kalia Copper, who is the only Sky player in double digits in this one. 9 points, 11 boards, 6 assists, and a steal for Courtney Williams. 7 points for Marina Mabry. 8 points and 7 boards for Alana Smith. I think all 8 of those points came in the first quarter, early surge. Steve, what popped for you in this Aces Sky game?
What popped for me? The Aces were ready. The Aces has been waiting for the playoffs for about 30 business days. So they came out ready. No clearer vision than Chelsea Gray immediately saying, hey, I'm here. Bop, bop, here we go. I thought their defensive activity was great. I thought in pick and roll, they were fighting the Sky's guards, getting over, working mm-hmm. to keep everything in front. Offensively, I think they made a lot of quick decisions. I'm sure you're going to point out some of the ways they were ready for the Sky's defense. Hey, you want to put 2 on the ball? Quick pass. Now we hit Asia high-low. Oh, you're not going to do that? Now we go pick and roll. Asia, you pop. Now you have space to work with. And I think it spoke to the difficulty of facing the Aces in the playoffs because there's not truly one thing you can take away, especially if you are the underdog to this degree. Mm-hmm. Because as soon as you shift some of that defensive capital to one thing, they're in a scenario where they're going to counter it, and it's going to be unfair how they do it. So I just thought it was the Aces showing off that quote-unquote championship mentality mm-hmm. and getting it done. On your rewatch of the game, what were your takeaways, sir?
This is a very rude team when they are locked in, was my primary takeaway. And it kind of started with, and I'm glad you asked me this in the watch party yesterday about the Aces counters. I was like, let me watch the game before I have a firmer answer. The high-low point, it's not something that the Aces haven't done this year, but you've more so seen that with teams are helping off Akia Stokes. We're going to flip it here and let her make a pass as a way to involve her. The fact that they start with a Jackie Young pick and roll, C is the switch. It's like, okay, cool. They run it with Kelsey Plum. She gets 2 to the ball, and then you get that high low with the pass to Chelsea and then immediate touch pass to Asia for an and one. That's like, huh, the fact that they're doing this with their big three is interesting to me. And they kept doing it until Chicago kind of shifted in the second half. Like, okay, nah, we're just going to turn this into a switch. And we'll just switch and scram out of it. We can't keep putting 2 to the ball because they have figured this out. Chicago tried to sprinkle in some zone. And every time Chicago went zone, Vegas did something with the edge of the zone. It was a Kelsey Plum drive early. It was a Chelsea Gray inbound and then pin in for Kelsey Plum. Then there's a little bit of ball movement and a random cut from Jackie Young on the opposite end after trying to pin in again. And it's like, hey, man, it feels like they have scouted everything that Chicago has done this year or tried to do against them this year, and they had an immediate answer for it. Chicago may counter from there, but by the time they try to counter, like, they had already been dinged. And the game snowballed early. Very much a back-and-forth affair, and then it's 27-15 after one. And Chicago reels it in, and next thing you know, like, we're flirting with a 20-point lead in the second quarter. It's like, well, this is what the Aces are going to do. Becky Hammon talked post-game about how impressed she was with the defense and how good she felt about the defense. And Steve, you already hit on it, but the amount of pressure that the guards put on Chicago's guards was something that surprised me. Surprised me positively. Not that I didn't anticipate them being ready, but that felt like the best defensive game of the season for Chelsea Gray. And the fact that that came in game one of the playoffs speaks to me. Kelsey Plum was locked in. Jackie Young had some off-ball stuff, but ultimately she was pretty darn good defensively last night. And if you're not getting the scoring from Marina, if you're only getting the playmaking from Courtney Williams, which she made some really good passes. And I think Chicago did have a little bit of fun with empty side stuff against Vegas in game one. But if you're only getting the playmaking from Courtney and it's not the she can pull up, she can drive and then also hit you with pass if you overreact, that's a different dynamic. And Kalia Copper had 15, but one, she saw a little bit of everybody. She saw some Jackie. She saw some Chelsea. The Aces switched some actions. They threw different coverages at her. She could never really get comfortable unless it was in transition. And I felt Vegas's transition defense was also pretty solid last night. And so it just felt like a team that knew what they needed to do on both ends of the floor, as cliche as that may sound. But like they had the counters on deck early, and that was fun for me on my rewatch in particular.
Yeah, I mean, that's where it's like, okay, we saw some of these things bother the Aces in the regular season, but I wonder how much did they just not hit the buttons they knew they could because they didn't want to show it then, which sounds like a crazy thing to say, but they're a very good team, so they might have just played through it. I think to your defense point, Courtney Williams, 4-for-11, Ka was 5-for-14, Marina was 3-for-10. If you make it tough, those are the three who can kind of flip the series to a degree. Mm-hmm. To where we can get baskets, we can make it tough on you. And now you end up with pick and roll coverage, you're showing help, you're protecting the paint. How many drives did they get? Like if the best driver for the Sky was Alana Smith.
And she got Asia with a couple of them lefty drives.
Oh, she was driving left. Catch, left, go. But, you know, even in pick and roll, when the Aces are going to drop, they stayed home on those guards. Hey, y'all figure it out. In there. help off the bigs and try and recover. And boy, Asia Wilson did some recovering, but they didn't give them those gaps. And the activity that you spoke of not only disrupted the Chicago Sky guards, but the flow, which we had question marks about before. I thought the Sky did try a lot of movement stuff, probably a little bit more than I thought. Problem is, screen deny or screen I'm here. Now we don't have anything. Now we go to pick and roll. Oh, they're there with help also showing. Okay. Now we swing and hold. What do we have? And that's where the Aces defense, I think, went from one level to the next in this game as far as just taking something away, making you do something you did not want to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the catch and hold just really popped for me on the rewatch. And like, I didn't even feel like it was Chicago's fault a lot of the time, to your point. The Aces were locked in on the initial stuff and the help was selective. We may be peeled in here because this player is standing here. If that player is standing elsewhere, I may be a little bit closer, but we got help peeled in elsewhere. And the Sky trying to sort through that, again, outside of like some pockets where they went empty side, they couldn't consistently find the pressure points to hit. And it didn't feel like, if I want to sum it up, it didn't feel like the Aces were in rotation a lot in that game one. Even when they would switch into stuff and scram, like it didn't feel like someone was cutting while they were trying to scram and scrambling that way or anything. They could not consistently get the Aces to move outside of what was happening in front of them. And if you can't do that, you're going to have a tough time, especially with the guards being as locked in as they were on ball with their pressure and doing so without fouling. And so I do wonder like how Chicago plans on kind of juicing that. Because to your point, like it, again, wasn't from a lack of effort. It's not like they didn't try to move some pieces around. I wonder what kind of actions they may have found, you know, when they go back and rewatch film. Like, is there something that they want to hammer a little bit more and try to get out of and force the Aces to move a little bit? Like, I do think if the Aces are going to switch as much as they are, like Chicago can stand to be a little bit more decisive or a little bit more intentional about throwing it inside and trying to generate some rim pressure that way. It may not be a traditional drive because we didn't see much of that in game one. But that be a way to at least force the Aces' eyeballs on the interior and lead to some inside-out stuff and hope you can win the map battle against the Aces, which is a daunting task. Like outside of Liberty, this is the best shooting team in the league. But, you know, the Sky do have people that can knock down pull-ups. They do have people that can knock down spot-ups. That may be their best path. One defensive thought that I had for Chicago, though. One, it's a testament to the Aces, because I do feel like at a certain point, they just kind of took the traps off the table for Chicago. I do wonder if the switching is going to be the thing for Chicago, if that's going to be their best shot. And just trust that the Aces aren't able to make as quick of the decisions that they were able to make in game one, especially when they saw two to the ball. It felt Chicago's defense to me felt more comfortable when they were switching and then scrambling when necessary versus anything else they did. The zone just did not work. The traps just for large portions just did not work. Didn't see a ton of drop, but I guess, am I alone in that? It felt like the switching is kind of it. I think they lean more into that in game two, if I had to guess.
I wouldn't be surprised if they do that. Now, the problem is, and this is something we love. We love defensive versatility. We love trying different things. We rarely talk about what happens when none of those things actually work. And now you got to sit back there and grab your notepad and try and figure out which one do we want to go with? Because here's the problem with switching, right? You start out switching, cool. You're going to give up some matchups you don't like. How are you going to play out of that? What does that open up? Are you ready for that portion? Also, the more you do it, the more the Aces will be ready, the more they'll counter that. And then what do you have behind it? So that's where you need to have your base on top of the other things you can do. You can't build the boat out of switching. You can't build the boat out of one thing against Aces, period.
Yeah.
But I don't know how comfortable they feel walking away after game one where pick a coverage, it got hit. And so now you're hoping for the do better button, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. Can we keep the ball in front? Can we be stronger on these cuts? Can we be better in pick and roll? But it's tough. Again, like Williams matched up against Asia. Sounds fantastic till Asia starts moving. Mm-hmm. Now she's coming off screens. Now it's pick and pop. Now she's in the post. She's just moving around. There's a bunch of different things she's doing. And you have the responsibility of trying to help defend these guards. You want to switch? Guard stop. One-on-one. Chelsea Gray saw Birch on her and said, I'm going to work. Tough. Kelsey Plum, quick pull-ups. Like, so it's not necessarily going to be built in that they're automatically going to tape jumpers. They could. Like, I guess you're hoping for them to stay on the perimeter and kind of get bogged down. But then eventually, like, how much time is that going to buy you? Zone, they distorted it. So it's just, can you find the blend that you want, that you feel comfortable with? And more importantly, like, I think offense is going to be more important for them. They're going to have to put the ball in the basket. I think that's to really get to the Aces. You got to score. You got to make them maybe think on the other end of the floor. Mm-hmm. I just, you know, seems dumb considering the winner is the person who scores more points, but I don't think you can go into a series against the Aces and hope that we can get them in the mud and maybe we can score enough. No, you have to take it to them on that end and then fight on the other.
Oh, I got you. I do have an offense question. While we're on Chicago's defense, I did have one for you. How did you feel about the way that they matched up? Because like live during the watch party, I thought the opening possession was, hey, wait a minute, why is Marina Mapier on Kia Stokes? After rewatching and seeing a different camera angle, that was just a very early screen set by Kia Stokes to pry Marina off of Jackie Young, and that's how that possession went, and then it was just straight the rest of the way. But like, is there any value to doing some different cross-matching in game two? Because like, I was just kind of in my thought bubble watching the games. Like, what does... Like, can you afford to go with a smaller player on Kia Stokes and try to move Alanna Smith around somewhere? Like, put her on Jackie and turn something into a switch, or put her on, like, do you put her on Asia? Or are there any cross-matching items that you could see from Chicago in game two?
Here's the problem with cross-matching. You have to assume the Aces won't just flip it right back at you. Because I really liked Alanna Smith guarding Kia Stokes to start, because even as the Aces space Stokes in the strong side corner, Smith had some really good rotations. She's very good at that. Really great rotations. Unfortunately for her, they did not matter because Asia finished anyways. But the idea is she can roam, she can help, we can play. That changes as soon as Alicia Clark comes into the game. Your roaming is now drive, 1-2 dribble, kick. I believe there's one of those possessions where AC got a three there. I don't know how much I love Marina on Stokes because eventually now you become Stokes becomes a screener again. And so is Marina going to switch? And then you're right back in the same boat. I don't. The way that Jackie attacked Smith when she got some of those switches, I don't know if you want to start that way. Like, are you going to have her navigate screens? Who's your roamer? Who's your helper? How are you not going to switch back? Like, what is your pick and roll coverage going to be once you flip these? That's always the question that I ask people when they say, hey, they should cross match. Cross matching has its value. Don't get me wrong. But if you are putting someone in a different scenario and your team has not defended that scenario, and now you end up in the same boat you were in the start, what value did you get out of it? I don't know if that's going to be the answer, because eventually someone you don't want to be guarding Chelsea Gray is going to be guarding Chelsea Gray. Someone you don't want to be guarding Kelsey Plum is going to be guarding Kelsey Plum. Someone you don't want to be guarding Asia Wilson is going to be guarding Asia Wilson. And you just hoping the Aces don't figure that out. And I don't know if they are, if they're going to do that, if they're this locked in.
Yeah, that is fair. And this is why I posed the question to you, good sir. But no, I guess for me, it's just like, one, it's a win or go home game two at this point, you know, bouncing off of the earlier conversation with Minnesota and Connecticut. Like, this is the throw the kitchen sink game. And if they are going to lean more into switching, like, I'd wonder if for no other reason, can we make the Aces burn a little bit more clock to try to get to what they want to get to? And does that give us a better chance to force some misses or some standard positions? We're able to get out in transition. We're able to get some easier buckets. And maybe that's the way we put some early pressure on them and give ourselves a better chance. So maybe the cross matching isn't a full blown for 40 minutes. We are doing this and we are having this player defend this player and we're going to have some fun. If it's just a counter to throw out to hopefully steal a few possessions.
What's more important to you, a defensive start for this guy or an offensive start for this guy?
Like, I think I'm aligned with you that the offense has to hit. I think. How many transition points did Chicago have last night? I think that's why my mind immediately goes there to how can they generate some easier opportunities? Because it felt like they weren't able to get that on top of the problems that the Aces were posing in the half court because of how locked in they were.
It was like 15 fast break points. I think. Well, here's the other part, right? The Aces didn't turn the ball over.
Yeah.
That makes it a lot different. And, you know, you go back to, I think, one of the last regular season matchups these two teams had. The sky jumped them, but they also got the assistance of the Aces turning the ball over. And so, I mean, this could be as simple as the Aces have the let's take pull-ups and turn the ball over game. And now Chicago's offense gets hot because they have three really good players in the guard room. And now some of the versatility defensively can pop a little bit more because it's a different scenario. We're not fighting an uphill battle. We're even or a little bit ahead. And it could be different that way. The issue is that they need the Aces to cooperate in some sort of fashion. And in game one, they had zero interest in doing that.
Yeah, they weren't here for it. I guess on that, I can't ask you the Chicago offense question. With Kalia Copper in particular, how did you feel about her usage in that game one?
I mean, it felt fine. I think they could have used her in more actions as far as coming off screens potentially. Mm-hmm. It seemed like she was on a mission to drive to the basket if once the shot kind of wasn't falling. And so, I don't know, can she get to the line? Can she get off some pin downs? You know, where are you going to put her on the floor? How much room can you give her? I guess is my question. Mm-hmm. Like, do you go to some rescreens to try and at least give her a driving lane? Because again, you go back to that game and look how active the Aces guards were and the screen navigation to work to get back in front most times. So, I mean, I was okay with it. I think it was one of those scenarios where they were trying to get all three going and they didn't necessarily know which button to hit. So I felt like you get one good action or then you get a pick and roll or then you get a transition drive, and it's kind of just back and forth. What were your thoughts?
For me, like, it would have been nice to get her on some more off-ball stuff. Like, that's kind of my initial thought, so I'm glad to hear that from you. I feel smarter now.
But you're plenty smart, bud.
Thanks. I appreciate you. But no, I didn't feel like there was... I feel like there was room for more. I'll put it that way. To try to loosen some stuff up. Especially with, again, the Aces. Not like they were unafraid to switch some of their guards. And zooming out with Chicago, like, maybe not to the Minnesota degree if we're going to bounce off that game. But, like, they have explored with having smaller players screen for Ka on and off the ball. And so, like, is that a way to generate some favorable matchups, make it a little bit easier for Ka to get downhill? Maybe that makes it easier for her to get to the free throw line, or if nothing else, just draws an extra drive ball. You open up some catch and shoot opportunities from there. Is that a way for them to kind of open up some more flow within their half court offense versus what we saw in game one? And then I guess on a related note, a quiet game for Marina Mabry. Is that
you couldn't resist, could you?
What you be? It's just 7 points, not what you want. In terms of her usage, is this just a matter of Marina plays better in game two? Or is there something you would like to see differently done for her by Chicago in this game?
I always think her blend of on ball and off ball is going to be the button. So her coming off more screens as well should be a benefit for this guy. You should be able to use three people in different ways, play second side actions, all that good stuff. So I'm always going to toot that horn. I think it's a lot of it is play better. You know, if she has one of those nights where she decides or gets buckets, any of the three, honestly, I think we have a different conversation about this guy. But my mind, as you talked, goes to, like you mentioned, the fast break points. We talked about it. Ace's transition defense was very good. So even in the moments where the Sky did get a stop, how often did they have an advantage? And how often did they flow after that?
Mm-hmm.
How much dribble penetration did the Sky get? How many rolls were open? How much drive and kick did they get to? Like, if you can't mix in that kind of stuff, your ceiling is lowered.
And it once again gets pretty tough to deal with a team as talented as the Las Vegas Aces. Any closing thoughts on this one before we move to the mailbag?
Just a very impressive performance from the Aces. I would, you know, they were really, 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 really locked in. Really, really just absurdly locked in. And that's when it gets real fun. They are unfair when they're hitting those notes.
Yeah, it's wild to think that they kind of left some stuff on the table offensively in that one, and they still put up 87 points, and offensive rating was high. So impressive effort from the Aces, impressive effort for the Sun. Once again, want to reiterate that, just the shooting, but also Connecticut also had a plan on both ends. The aggression defensively, the ball movement and tempo offensively. They were there. Excited to see what those game twos look like. Also, just as we record on a Thursday, the game ones for Liberty Mystics and also Dream Wing on Friday at night. I am excited to tap into those. We will have analysis. We will have analysis on that series on the next pod. I'm excited to tap in with that one. We can transition to the mailbag from there. Want to quickly say thank you to those who have sent in and continue to send in mailbag questions. Again, you don't have to wait for a prompt from us. If you have basketball thoughts, email us at dunkerspot@yahoo.com. That is dunkerspot@yahoo.com. We're going to start with Steven, a friend of the program. Love the great insights and perspectives you all continue to share. I'm proud to support. Appreciate you, dog. A few questions for Steve. Number one, there's been plenty of conversation around questions posed by media this season on the W side of hoop impressors. As a former coach, what's your perspective on these instances this season? Even more, what type of style of questions would you like to hear pre or post game if you were a head coach or player?
Well, this seems like an Nikias question, but I'll try my best. From what I've observed, I don't have all of them memorized in my head by heart right now.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like timing and phrasing have been an issue with some of these. Like, there are certain times you ask certain questions, certain ways you may try and beat around certain questions, if that makes sense. You got to know there's a push and pull there. I had to learn that the hard way. Certain things coaches are going to want to talk about in certain situations. There's certain things they aren't going to want to talk about. And I think part of what's forgotten in this era is coach speak has gone down for the most part. Like, it still exists, but there's a lot of quality answers that are provided. A lot more detail is given out than before. Like, this is not the both teams played hard, we gave our best era, so there's good stuff out there. I think the issue is being able to read the room and understand which question you want to hit and ask it to that person. And you might have an idea, but the person in front of you may not be the person who's going to lend or have a thought about that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, don't ask me, star player, about the bench. I have one of two paths to go. And I'm probably not picking one of them. So, you know, if you ask a question to the coach and they say, ask the players, that may not actually be ask the players. That may just be, I don't want to talk about that because I've been talking about it all season. And they know.
Yeah.
And if you don't read that and then you actually ask the player who has heard about that all season long and just felt the effects of a loss, you may not like the answer that you get. Mm-hmm. That's part of the game. Unfortunately, you got to read the room. You got to read the offense, the defense. There's different times, different moments. I understand access. I understand all of that. But you got to have a feel for it. And then for me, it's sometimes just, hey, use your time as a prompt. You may have an idea of what you're thinking and look for confirmation or denial. But the idea is you want to get the coach talking. Forget talk about questions. I don't like the 45-second questions. I can't retain that information. So I'm trying to look for the last word that you said. I'm going to bounce off that. Oh, yeah. The defense was great. I thought great effort. We were second half. I thought we were really strong. And now I done forgot what you said at the start. And especially if it's a scenario where you may be looking to inform me or you're providing information that may come off sideways. Because then it's like, are you actually asking a question? Or are you telling me something? So, I mean, that would be my beat on it. Am I that far off?
No, I do not think you are far off at all. And I will just reiterate, the reading the room portion is very important. Like, it's also important to know, like, you know, you mentioned the don't ask the star player about the bench type thing. Like, having that level of discernment is also important. But like reading the room in general, like there have been many a times that I have been in pressers on the Aces or elsewhere where I have a thought bubble or I saw something in game or I've seen something across the stretch games that I want to ask about, and player or coach walks in and I can immediately tell I am not going to get the answer I want if I ask this tonight or if I ask this today. Because it's either, you know, post game and insert team or player here just lost, or, you know, these are human beings. They may just be having a rough one. Or it may be, you know, go back to when I asked Asia and Alicia questions ahead of the Washington game, where I asked Asia a question. I had three lined up. I asked Asia one question and she answered. I could tell by tone of her voice. Ah, yeah, she's feeling the road trip. Let me just get this second quick one and I'll just save this third one for another time. Because I can tell, like, this isn't the arena. It's the arena because it was like post shoot around. It was like me and two other people. So I could have just asked a bunch of questions. But I recognize in that moment, no, she's tired. Like, this is like game eight in like 13 days. Let me chill and I can get to this some other time. So like recognizing when you can get into your stuff, what gives you the best odds of getting your question answered. I think that's something that comes with experience, but you got to be able to do that. And I do think the players, coaches that you talk to, if they can tell, they tell if you're there consistently that you also have them in mind versus I'm trying to get this quote or I'm trying to sound super smart and whatever the case may be. That stuff, you can't hide that for very long if that's how you're coming into it.
I just think building trust is important these days. And you got to remember, like, I'm not trying to like say every answer is acceptable or should happen, but these are human beings. And, you know, they might be in one mood 1 minute and then they might hear something on their way to the press conference room. You don't know what they heard. Now they don't want to talk or they don't want to answer certain things, or, you know, they might have heard a whisper about something that was said. You know, there are different elements that may change that press conference that I don't think people understand.
Yeah. Can I quickly bounce off of that?
What's up?
For my media pals, just off of that note. If someone ahead of you asks a question and the player does not have a great reaction to that question, that probably isn't the time for you to bounce off of that. Don't bounce off of that. Don't bounce off of that. I understand why you may want to.
No, leave it stuck on the ground.
It's not gonna go well for you. I can assure you. Like, it's, I guess on a more general note, this is also why I'm very much in the camp of, hey, make sure you are phrasing things in an appropriate way. Because you want to give yourself the best chance of, again, getting the answer that you want slash need, depending on what your job description is. Like, you don't. You just got to be careful with some stuff.
I'll add to it. And I'm not like interviewer of the year. I'm not even really media man. But my idea, if I'm asking someone a question, I just want you to talk. I'm not going to say talk about, but I just want to get you talking. That's mm-hmm. all I want to do. It ain't about me. I think for every guest that we've had on this pod, I have asked a stupid question. But I was trying to get to something. And then I was trying to get to something off that. And I was trying to get to something off that. If you go in to these, I know it's tough with the presser because you really like, you have an idea of what you're trying to go with.
Mm-hmm.
But like, it just limits you. Because now if they don't want to participate in whatever you're going with, you're still going with your thought. You have no confirmation or denial. And now it's just, okay.
Nice stuff.
You run a dribble handoff. The ball's denied. You already picked up your dribble. Help. Or, remember, athletes, very competitive. Can't get after you with trash talk. Now you get popped online. Now you're part of a viral debate for at least a day and a half. So, I don't know, man. That's my thought.
Okay.
What type of questions? I like a lot of the questions. Nakai's asked some really good questions. There's a lot of good question answers out there. I don't have the whole breakdown. I'm sorry, y'all. Y'all do great work. But I feel like there's a way to get coaches to talk about stuff. And people have done a really good job of that as we've gone on. There's been an evolution and a shift there.
Mm-hmm.
You just gotta know the vibes, practice your craft, know the team, feel the, you know, read the room. There's some days I pop on this little Zoom. I see Nakai's face. I'm like, okay, we ain't going there today. Let me take this joke out the intro. Take this joke out the intro. All right.
Oh, that's wild. I wasn't expecting the. I got to make sure I come in with.
Don't do that. That's the next question. Cheese and rice. What's the next one?
That was for the bit. I assure you. We good. Second question from Steven. Could you take us through what pregame, halftime, postgame coaches' meetings go through? How is balance struck between attention to opponents versus attention to one's own team? How much real-time analytics are considered versus the box score returns?
I mean, it depends on which pregame meeting you're talking about. The bulk of the pregame meeting is probably going to be before shoot-around or in the morning of that game where you're really locking in, hey, well, this is what we want to do. This is what they're running. Go over the tape. Going through with the team. You know, whether you're watching film with them, walk through in the ballroom, whatever it is. That's going to be the bulk of it. Now, as far as the game plan portion goes of it, the balance, I'll talk about that real quick.
Okay.
It gets tricky because you do have to pay attention to what your opponents are doing. You have to be able to tell their story, but you have to know in the back of your head, what are they going to do to us? That's one of the tricky things where you can have all the knowledge about a team, only they run different stuff against you because you got a different weakness than the five teams they played before y'all. So you have to balance that with, okay, what are our issues? Pick and roll defense. They got a point guard that shoots pick and roll. They might put us in pick and roll. So these are the actions they like to run, but they might put us in pick and roll. So we have to make sure we are tight with pick and roll. We have to make sure our doubles. So you know what I mean? Those little things are where you want to tweak it. And then you got to figure out how you're going to score. So a team that defends one way may just say, hey, we're going to trap you or we're going to double you. And that's where you got to scout and understand how they treat star players, how they treat post players, what are they doing pick and roll when this is happening. So it is a balance and it gets tougher as the season progresses because you may have a game that you played a team, but you didn't play them. You know, you play them 2 months later and it's like, well, this game has value, but it also doesn't have value.
Mm-hmm.
How do I sprinkle that in? So you just kind of have to balance that. Halftime is pretty quick. It's quicker than most people think. I mean, you're trying to gather exactly what you want to talk about. Watch a few clips. Try to understand what's hurting us. What adjustments you want to make, if any, and what message you want to send to the team. Because what you may say in that room may not be the full thing of goes to the other room. Because, you know, obviously trying to keep everything up, trying to win a game. Just depends on that. Post game. Depends, man. Did we win? Did we lose? So, I mean, I've been in a part of some very long post game meetings. I've been a part of some very short post game meetings. That's more of a vibe deal. Hopefully that answers. How much real-time analytics are considered? Analytics would probably go in the build-up more than during the game, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. I mean, they hand out a box score every 2 minutes, so advantage box score.
Yeah.
No disrespect.
Understandable. I wonder, like, if there's like a coach on, you know, second row or something that has like cleaning the glass pulled up, like, hey, in the half court, we doing this right now. We need to, et cetera, et cetera. Or like the live second spectrum stuff or whatever.
Hey, they might these days, because back in my day, you couldn't have the computer and the iPads out there like that. So they very well might have that and go through it and sprinkle that in at halftime. I wouldn't be surprised by that. I also wouldn't be surprised if that might not be the time to deliver that information.
I guess that's the question I have. Like, how could it get, I guess it just goes back to like reading the room, like knowing, okay, I have 8 stats here. Maybe share 4 of them with coach to help emphasize the point without pushing him over the edge of like frustration if you're losing or something like that.
When are you going to do that? You might get 1.
Ah.
Well. Yeah, I remember there's like 7-8 of y'all.
Yeah.
You are not getting your stuff off. You better have the one thing you want to say, the one thing that you saw. But then again, that changes because you do have the little huddle during the timeout, so you can mention what you're seeing and that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it might not be the time to be like, hey, they've hit 68.7% of their above the break threes off 2 dribbles. I'm just being honest.
It goes back to your clip mode. Yo, what are you talking about? Oh, goodness. Third question from Steven. A lot of times when a team has a cerebral point guard like Magic, Chris Paul, Steve Nash, Jason Kidd, Rondo, Sue Bird, Chelsea Gray, we often hear coaches note that they let them run the show for major stretches of games. When a team has a defensive player of the year caliber anchor, how often, if ever, does a head coach allow the same for said player in enabling them to bark out coverages, especially against a superstar?
You have to be a very good defensive player to be able to get that, to get those keys. It's a little different with defense because all 5 really have to be on the same page. Mm-hmm. So even if you are a great defensive player and maybe you flip a coverage, if no one else knows it or if no one else can execute it, it don't really have the same value. So it gets tricky there. I do think top defensive players have some autonomy when it comes to defense. As far as maybe they might gamble a little bit more. Maybe they might go under if we're supposed to go over. So we'll see that kind of stuff. Like Tony Allen was always a great example to me. You couldn't get the Tony Allen defense without the Tony Allen gamble.
Mm-hmm.
And so you had to live with some of those. But Mark and Mike were so good together defensively that sometimes they might just come up with something real quick. Hey, send them this way real quick. But everyone was on the same page of what they were doing. It didn't hurt the back line, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So yes and no, it's just different. And plus there's a lot of communication that comes from the defensive anchor anyways, as far as communicating to the rest of the team and what they're supposed to do. Like you see Draymond, you've seen Bam do it more. You've seen Embiid do it as far as just pointing and talking and the importance of communication. And so they kind of have that autonomy to run it in that sense. But you can't necessarily flip it right away.
Mm-hmm.
That's where you get in trouble.
Got you. I guess on that front, a question I have for you then, like, how do you find that threshold for we got to live with some of these? Because obviously you can't put like an exact number of, like, okay, this guy has 5 gambles and a half. And if he makes the 6, then we got to talk to him. But like, how do you kind of find that middle ground with some of those players?
Oh, you just mentioned the timeout. if it's something that really starting to hurt you, but it's got to be a pattern. You know, if it's one gamble, backdoor cut, cool. If it's gamble, now you gamble on the weak side. Now they're designing plays because you're gambling. Hey, you know what I mean? Stay solid. Stay solid. Just stay in front. You don't have to deny that. We'll be fine. Or, you know, it just kind of depends on the activity and who you're playing, who you're guarding. There's context for everything, but it's not something you just immediately jump down a player's throat for unless it's something you've talked about. Now, if we said, hey, watch out for this backdoor cut on this play and you go out there and deny, then that's different. Because what were you doing? Why did you do that? Freaking Spurs, Manu, backdoor cut every time. Let me loop under the post and go to the free throw line and plant my foot, and now I'm backdoor. Watch the back. Okay. Sweet. Love that.
I love that you have an example in mind. Very cool. Very cool.
Trauma.
Oh, no. Well, we are going to move on past. We'll go to a couple of quick ones to close this out. This one's going to come from Quentin. Hey, guys, this year's draft class, particularly Amen Thompson, has had me thinking a lot about athleticism. Amen seems to have a rare combination of the obvious run, jump, dunk athleticism of guys like John Westbrook, as well as the more subtle flexibility and body control of a guy like Shai. Not to mention he's 6'7". With LeBron past his physical peak, Giannis might be the only other current player I'd confidently say is at least as athletic as Amen. Anyway, I was wondering how you guys conceptualize athleticism on a basketball court, what types of athletes you value, and who you think the greatest athletes are in the NBA and WNBA, both current and historically.
Ooh, well, with athleticism, I guess it depends where and how is that being used and what is its impact? Mm-hmm. Are you jetting in transition? If you're big, are you rim running? Is this applying to defense? We're now sliding your feet, shuffling, keeping everything in front. You can defend multiple positions. Driving, finishing. For me, it's can you change speeds? Like, can you do, what else can you do? I guess is my thought. Mm-hmm. Sounds crazy, but I don't know if you can only bring that to the table. And the athleticism, it's breathtaking. We can all see that. But are you using it to the best of your abilities? Like a Ja or a Westbrook, where, okay, you have the turbo button. Do you know when to use it? Do you know how to use it? Do you know where to use it? Does it help you on one end of the floor? Does it help you on both ends of the floor? Like, that's where I get. And I also think of like the, you know, 6'7 or 6'10 athlete. Okay. Can you screen? Can you roll? What good is your athleticism if they are switching your screen?
Yeah.
You know, if you're an athlete and you can defend on the perimeter, but you're not defending on the perimeter. Okay. What good is that? This sounds like a musty take, but that's where my mind goes to with athleticism. Mm-hmm. Breathtaking, awesome to see, but I don't think it's the thing it was at one point in time. You need it, obviously, but you got to bring something else to the party with you.
Yeah, true. Like, I think for me, I get one to bounce off of what you said. Like, I'm right there with you. Like, athleticism, especially like to the quote unquote traditional run and jump, super fast, whatever athleticism, like it's got to be functional. The athleticism means next to nothing to me if it isn't functional, if you don't know how to use it. Like, there is, as I'll put it this way, like, there is a difference between Brandon Clark and Kai Jones, who are both super athletic, who both can slip, et cetera, et cetera. If you need a pick and roll partner, you are picking Brandon Clark before you pick Kai Jones. Even though Kai Jones runs faster, jumps, I don't want to say a lot higher because I don't want to disrespect Brandon Clark, at least pre-injury. We'll see what it looks like this upcoming season. But like knowing how to slip and knowing how to put that together, knowing when to decelerate to set the screen, flip your hips without losing your balance, and then being able to accelerate and then jet and make yourself a target and being able to put all that together. Like, it's not, everyone doesn't have that. Everyone can't put that together consistently, especially. So like, to quickly bounce off what Steve said, like, it has to be functional no matter what your level is. As far as what I am like prioritizing a little bit more, like I would imagine Steve laughs at me, like he could probably guess at this point, but like, I have very much become like a deceleration merchant over the last few years. Being able to see, there it is. the guys that can rev down and not just rev down, but rev down in an instant and make a decision, whether that's offensively or defensively, I think it's very important, especially in today's NBA where it's a lot spacier. You have to be able to change directions more quickly. And offensively, if teams are trying to shrink space against you, you got to be able to read that without drawing a whole bunch of offensive fouls. And so I guess the combination of like deceleration and also just like that short, like short area burst matters a little bit more to me than like traditional north-south speed. Like being able to, again, being able to navigate those tight spaces when they come. Like this is why I am a huge Shai fan. And I think he's one of the best athletes in the NBA. He's not the fastest guard in the league. He's not the highest jumper in the league. That man can get to wherever he needs to go because he can decelerate and accelerate. If you try to shrink the floor against him, he's able to read that. Has the flexibility to kind of shrink himself if he needs to. Has just the general flexibility to be able to alter his strides as he's driving and as he's gathering. And maybe to flip it that way. Like I enjoy watching him drive. I enjoy watching Giannis drive, you know, going back to the original question. Like being able to change stride lengths and change how quickly you're doing that. Like I think that's incredibly valuable in today's league. So I guess to answer that last part, best athletes in the league or in the leagues rather. Like I am a huge fan of, again, huge fan of Shai, huge fan of Giannis. Like it's dipped at this point because he's so much later in his career. But like a lot of this applies to what James Harden was in Houston, where you didn't think of him as a traditional run jump athlete, even though he can get up. But like the way that he was able to mix in speeds, his strength, his balance, the flexibility, et cetera, like that all came into play and made him one of the most difficult players in the league to cover. And even at this stage of his career, he's still pretty difficult to deal with. And that speaks to all of those other elements. On the W side, if we're talking like, I guess like stride, length, flexibility, stuff like that, like Kalia Copper pops for me in that regard as well. Deceleration. Like Kelsey Plum probably is an underrated one because she is like traditionally fast, but she decelerates very well and also has like the short area stuff that works. Who else pops for me? Alyssa Thomas would also work. Her strength, coordination, flexibility. Who else? I can leave my list there. Do you have any players you want to shout out in this?
All of them. you're all athletes in my heart, bud.
They're all athletes in my heart. You know what? We will take it. Last quick one from Eli. Do either of you have a particularly memorable 2K rating, particularly in regards to silliness? As a Magic fan, my standout is Jason Smith having a higher vertical at launch than Aaron Gordon in 2K16.
Take it away, Nakai. This seems like your bag.
First, I would just like to say, Eli, I appreciate you, big dog.
Let me get out the way real quick. Sorry, big dog. I didn't mean to cut you off. Let me just get it out the way real quick. I do find it interesting that Trae Young has the same three-pointer as Lonzo Ball.
Mm-hmm.
I'll leave it there. What you got for us?
I'm trying to find the tweet because like there was one year, like what I do with 2K every year. Because normally, like if you pre-order, you got to wait for it to download. Then once it downloads, you can play the game, but you can't play the complete game yet. Mm-hmm. So you still have to wait for like the second download. So during mm-hmm. that first one, it's like, all right, cool. Let me look at the rosters. Let me see what the overall ratings are. But let me see what these individual player ratings are. Let's look at tendencies, et cetera, et cetera.
Now, that's before you get to the part where you go to like the MyNBA and you go look at you in social media.
Yep.
Is that before that? Where does that enter in? You can check out Nekias Duncan on the social media tab in NBA 2K24, the 2K Duncan. I was trying to get your process, how that worked. Is that
that is a tremendous shot.
Is that a day two deal or?
That's wild. I will say this year, like I did the rating stuff and then I went to my gym like, okay, let me sim a little bit and let me see if I'm actually in this year. Let's see if it worked. And sure enough, I was in, so it's very cool. Anyway, I have now located the tweet from 2K21, which got a lot more traction than I anticipated. The tweet reads from September 4th, 2020, so that would have been, 2K21. An annual 2K tradition, Russell Westbrook has a better perimeter defense rating than Wes Matthews at 78, D'Anthony Melton at 81, Justice Winslow at 79, Frank Ntilikina at 82, Torrey Craig at 79, Bruce Brown at 77, Derek White at 82, Mikal Bridges in all caps. I was very upset about that one. At 80, Javon Carter at 79, Lou Dort at 80, and Josh Okogie at 81. And I had the straight face emoji. I was not pleased. So I guess that one would count. And then with last year's game on the W side, I was just not pleased with like a lot of the athleticism stuff. Like it was just like Ileana Rupert had like the highest bird. I think Sabrina Ionescu was the fastest player in the league. And I was just like, hey, man, I don't know about this one. I don't know if this is it. And there's always some fun stuff with like the 3-point rating. Cause I think that's very much formula. What did you shoot type beat, especially since 2K went away from the, like there was a spot, there was like a catch and shoot 3-point rating and then an off the dribble 3-point rating. Now it's all just one. And so it's just like, hey, how exactly do you weigh these? Because like, yeah, Trey might have a lower percentage than insert player here, but he's taking a whole bunch of 29-foot pull-ups. It's a little bit different. You probably shouldn't have him as like an 81 because he's taking really difficult shots. But I guess that's what the badges are for, and that leads into a whole deeper conversation about how the ratings and the badges work. So thank you for the prompt. I think that is all I have there. Steve, do you have free throws?
I don't. Do you?
I have a few.
Let's go.
Okay. Well, while we're on the 2K side, early 2K24 thoughts.
Very fun. I think the gameplay has been fun for me. Like, I'm not a grinder at this point yet. I'm not the elite. I'm not talking about the lag on the dribble moves. I ain't talking about the badges or the builder. It's fun to play the game. The substitution thing they did has been fun. Mm-hmm. It's nice to actually have like the other team have a good player on the court in the second quarter. So you can't just spam the second quarter anymore. And the AI is smarter in some areas. Like I think the first time I played, I was Denver and I played OKC and Shea was driving like none other. And then I finally figured that out and then they kept moving the ball and then Shea back cut. And I was like, wait a minute. What is happening here? Mm-hmm. Playing as Wembanyama is fun. I should run him in pick and roll. But yeah, it's a fun experience. Feels smoother. I've enjoyed my time so far. What do you have any thoughts?
I do have thoughts. I have a question for you though. So just for clarification's sake, you are saying that you are glad that 2K has gone away from the full-blown hockey subs?
You can do the hockey subs. I just like that there's like a thought process behind it. You start the second quarter with a really good player.
Okay.
Nice attempt, pal.
Pro staggering. I feel you.
No. I'm pro bench, bud.
Okay. I'm just curious. But no, I'm right there with you. Like, I've enjoyed the gameplay. I will say it was a little bit of adjustment for, like, I actually have to, like, think through Hall of Fame difficulty on my career now. And since I've had to make that mental adjustment, it's been a lot of fun trying to put that together. But, buddy, let me tell you, I went against Steph Curry. I have a small forward place for Denver, much like last year. But anyway, played the Warriors on Hall of Fame, right? First three plays of the game, I am watching Jamal Murray just die on every screen that he has put in. And I was like, oh, that Steph made all three of his threes. I was like, oh, no, we are not about to have this. Let me guard Steph. And I did okay. Steph did still finish with 40 plus. He went 8 of 20 from 3. And so if we're doing he did much better against Jamal Murray than he did against me. But I was in a headlock trying to navigate staggers, pin downs. They go to split stuff. And like there was one three in the third quarter. Steph was in the right corner. Brother, when I tell you I got like an 80-something% contest on the shot and that man greened it anyway, I was like, oh, well, this is Steph. But also, I did what I was supposed to do. I got the challenger badge. It activated. I got good shot contest in the little thing. My teammate grade went up. It just did not matter. And I was like, okay, this is just what it's going to feel like. The Steph matchup was not fun. In the season opener, it was Denver, LA. So like I just had LeBron since we're both a small four. And that man that was like 85 overall me. So like he's just shoulder in chest every drive. I'm just flying. It's like, okay, well, nothing I can really do with this. I say all that to say I am having fun with it. Feels like there have been some tweaks to like the badge progression stuff with the new system. So I'm kind of holding my tongue on that. Like, I'll probably get that a few more weeks before I have firm takes on it, see how it works. But I've enjoyed it. I'm excited to actually explore with some of my NBA stuff a little bit later and really dig back into it, because I didn't do as much of that last year. But no, it's been good. It's been good. I'm enjoying myself. Heading back to the playoff realm, a better chance at notching things up on Sunday, the Sky or the Lynx?
Lynx. Lynx by default. No, that's no disrespect to the Sky. That seems super disrespectful, but the Aces have, what, lost maybe a handful of times in the last calendar year in Las Vegas. So I'm just going to use the odds, as they say.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Dawana Bonner or Natasha Howard?
This season?
Yeah.
Natasha's had a really good year. I'll probably go Dawana.
Okay. Alana Smith or Tiana Hawkins?
Ooh, Tiana Hawkins had some really nice performances. Really helped the Mystics. I'm going Alana. The defense has been very good.
Okay, got you. Rank these players in terms of Team USA likelihood next year. Trae Young, Jaren Jackson Jr., Austin Reeves, Bobby Portis.
Trae Young is last for me, just based on things I've read.
Okay.
Bobby Portis is probably going to be third. Austin Reeves, two. But I think with the amount of wings and guards that allegedly want to go ahead and do this, I'm not seeing it.
Mm-hmm.
Jaren probably won.
Okay. Fair enough. Last one I have for you. More likely to start in December, Rashad Penny or Christian Wood?
Christian Wood. It better be Christian Wood, because your stinking Eagles picked up Kenneth Gainwell in fantasy, and this man ain't even playing. Now I got to watch Swift and Penny go off, and this man's going to be useless. Man, this last time I do the Eagles thing, I try to support my friend, be like, yeah, you know, he told me Gainwell was going to be cooking, and he kind of cooking. And now he done, man.
I mean, to be fair, he did kind of cook in week one. He just got hurt.
Man, yeah, yeah, it's not great. Now, you can't get hurt when you got 14 running backs. That never ends well in fantasy. That is, you better clock back in, bud. So we'll see how that works. Okay, I got one for you then.
Okay.
Do you believe the Taylor Swift Kansas City Chiefs conspiracy?
No.
Yeah, come on, Eagle man. That's your friend.
Oh Lord. I want no parts of that.
What you mean? She an Eagles fan? You an Eagles fan?
Yeah. The only Swift I recognize is
DeAndre? That's it?
No, I'm kidding. I'm sure Taylor's a cool person. But no, I just
Swifties attack.
All right, that's where we go. All right, thank you for listening to this episode of The Dunker Spot. If you have not already, please subscribe to us. We are on Apple, Spotify, Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcasts. You can find us. You can follow me on Twitter at NikaiasNBA. You can follow Steve on Twitter at SteveJones20. Join the Dunker Spot community on Twitter if you haven't already. Having some fun talks in there. Join us for our online Dunker Spot watch parties. Again, we are watching all of the W playoff games, so come tap in with us on Friday. Fun doubleheader. We got Wings Dream. We got Liberty Mystics. Are we going to try to sprinkle in some SmackDown here? Probably not. We'll see. We'll see how the commercial breaks work. We'll see if we can sprinkle it in. In general, we do watch wrestling as well. We tapped in with some tennis. We watched volleyball yesterday, according on Thursday. So we watched some volleyball on Wednesday. That was cool. It was a lot of cool. It was Stanford, Nebraska. They were hooping. Hoops. Anyway, the link to the online Dunker Spot watch party room should be in your podcast description. If so, just click on that link, enter your information. It is free. No shenanigans. If not, copy and paste the link into your browser. It is free. Once again, no shenanigans. And with that, we will catch y'all next week.
Hey, in 2015, Nikias was mad that Taylor Swift got a banner. Toodles.